Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. As it turns out, we're going to have to reschedule the author of Assisted Loving, Bob Morris, but we do have a terrific archive show for you instead. How is global power divided, and how big a share can the U.S. expect to have in the decades to come? Believing that economic strength will count for more than military might in the 21st century, my guest today sees three superpowers, the U.S., the EU, and China. And while they are unlikely to fight each other over political boundaries, modern-day postmodern superpowers will battle for control of economic resources that lie within so-called second-world countries around the globe. Parag Khanna is Senior Research Fellow at the New America Foundation. I originally spoke with him last April upon publication of his book, The Second World, Empires and Influence in the New Global Order. Parag, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much, Chris. Good to be here.
So you have these three superpowers which share the reality of enormous economies that continue to grow. What, though, are the most important differences between them?
Well, the differences are most certainly in their diplomatic styles, how they go about trying to build influence across the second world. What we've seen in the last, you know, decade in particular is that our, as an American, diplomatic style is what I call coalitional. It's transactional. We go on an issue-by-issue basis, such as the war on terror, and we're trying to form relationships. But countries become our allies, and then the next, you know, year or a couple of years later, they're our enemies. So it's not sort of permanent or binding anymore. It's very much in flux. Europe's approach is different. I call it the consensus approach. They lock countries in through deep internal reforms and make them members of the European Union. And that's literally a permanent state of being. You don't see any country dropping out of the EU once they're in. And what China does is what I call the consultative style of diplomacy, where they don't deal with politically sensitive matters at all, and they just focus on areas of mutual agreement and try and have cooperation on that. Mostly, of course, it's about building business and energy kinds of ties. And so those are the three differences among them as they go out and pursue influence in the second world.
What's so extraordinary about the EU is that obviously it is still growing. There are member states clamoring to get in, or would-be member states. Mm-hmm. Is there any scenario by which it could add states located far outside its geographic borders?
And that's obviously the big question, or the trick in a way. How does Europe retain its massive appeal beyond its own geographic area? It actually does have a tremendous amount of influence in North Africa, particularly because of the energy relationship that it has with North African gas supplies and the overwhelming share of the investment that goes into North Africa from Europe. Beyond that, it actually has a lot of influence in East Asian business. I mean, if you go to China, the story isn't actually American businesses, although we believe that we have a huge trade. We do have a huge trade deficit with China. Europe's is actually as large or larger, and European businesses do tremendously well there. Europe also has a lot much deeper political relations with different elements of the Chinese government. When you talk about human rights reform and all these things that we would like to see in China, bear in mind that America actually has absolutely zero impact on that. We don't have any of those rule of law in China programs that we used to have in the 1990s in the Clinton administration. Europe, however, does. And so whatever positive steps you might see happen in China with respect to improving governance, cleaning up corruption, allowing more freedom for judges to operate, civil society building, also environmental protection, almost all of that stuff is because of Europe, not because of us.
Are there times in which the EU's multiculturalism actually works against it?
Well, I mean, that's the same question that people ask here. I mean, you hear all the time in news in the United States that Europe is falling apart from within, and it has such trouble integrating its Muslim or Arab, minority populations. You know, in a way, on a socioeconomic kind of basis, we obviously have the same set of challenges here. There is clearly, you know, a broader xenophobic tone in European politics that is less prominent here in the United States. But I do feel that they're waking up to that, and that they are obviously curbing migration in some ways. They're moving towards admitting or prioritizing skilled migrants, which is not something that the U.S. does as much. And so they're well aware, I would say, of this, and are trying to tackle it as strongly as the U.S. is.
There are some people who worry that we'll never be able to compete with China once it's sort of fully online, given that at least currently there's virtually no enforcement of intellectual property laws. There are no prescriptions against bribery even to secure contracts. How should we deal with that reality?
It's something that has to be done on a case-by-case basis. Look, I mean, a lot of the improvements that happen in Chinese corporate governance are due to international partnerships with European companies or American companies. They're so worried about the collapse of state-owned banks and so forth that they allow American and European corporations to buy in and buy a greater share, because that way, of course, you know, the burden and the risk is shared, which in a way, forces us to clean up their mess sometimes. So on a case-by-case basis, we are actually working on making sure that they enforce certain contracts, operate according to certain global, which happen to be Western, corporate governance standards and so forth. But it's going to have to happen industry by industry, case by case. And because, of course, you know, the deeper dynamic within which all of this functions is the desire of the Communist Party to retain control. And so everything has to move in slow, incremental, measured kinds of ways. But I assure you, there's no silver bullet. We're doing the best we can.
Parag Khanna is my guest. He's a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation. His book is called The Second World, Empires and Influence in the New Global Order. Parag, are the values of corporations as they exist as their own entities, are those fairly universal regardless of the country of origin and regardless of the laws that might govern the way they operate within that country?
No, I mean, there's multiple types of corporations today. You have the rise or the return of state-owned companies, particularly in the energy sector and sovereign wealth funds, which, of course, are both getting a lot of scrutiny today. We literally 10 years ago, you heard people talking about the privatization of everything and corporations taking over. Well, I mean, and you know, some of the most important sectors, such as state-owned banks and certainly state-owned energy, you have a massive revival. Look at Venezuela, look at Russia as just two of the most prominent examples, and you have a nationalization kind of tendency going on. So the notion that corporations have a very simple, you know, mentality when it comes to placing the only value on profit is not really the case, especially if there is national interest or national security objectives that those firms have if they're serving or tied to a particular government. And then there's the awakening that's happening in much of the global private sector that relates to the notion of corporate citizenship and what is the social role of companies. So it's no longer so simple as government is for good and for public goods, private sector is only for profit, and all NGOs are the most moral actors. We can't really think of the world as divided that way. That's far too simple.
Well, what is so interesting about the idea of corporate citizens in the world is that as the world becomes more economically controlled, as opposed to militarily controlled or controlled by governments, suddenly you have diplomacy, really, on the part of different corporations. Is there any way for the governments of China, the EU, or the U.S. to ensure that corporations that exist within their borders are acting in the best interest of the country?
I guess the question is, which country do you mean, right? There's the sort of when in Rome, an American corporation operating factories in Indonesia, such as Nike, for example, obviously isn't conforming to American labor standards or wages or whatever the case may be. And the debate is, can you hold companies to the higher standards of their home environment? And if you do that, are they just going to relocate, you know, to the Middle East or elsewhere where there's less regulation? So would we be shooting ourselves in the foot by doing that? That's much of what the debate today is about when it comes to corporate regulation of particularly sort of, you know, labor-intensive sorts of industries. But I don't think that governments are going to succeed at making companies act that way, because to a large extent, when even in the development community, the economic development and poverty studies sort of areas, people realize that it is, in fact, economic activity in the presence of foreign corporations that actually stimulates economic growth and helps reduce poverty. So you really can't cut, you know, or bite the hand that feeds you in a way.
What are the most important second world states right now?
In the book, I focus on quite a few of them, but Turkey, Venezuela, Brazil, Libya, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Kazakhstan, Uzbekistan, Malaysia, Indonesia, those are some of the most important ones. And the book has sort of, you know, lengthy chapters on each of them.
I suppose we should step back for a minute and define second world as you see it.
Sure. I mean, it's two sets of characteristics. The term, some listeners may recall, used to refer to socialist countries allied with or members of the Warsaw Pact or Soviet Union. But we stopped using the term about 15 years ago. But to me, we still, you know, because we still say first world or third world, albeit very loosely, there's still a need for a term that captures these countries that are neither first world, developed, modern, connected, rich, globalized, or third world that are sort of, you know, underdeveloped, potentially backwards in civil war, whatever the case may be. And there's a lot of countries that fall in between, I would say at least 100 of them. And so that was one socioeconomic kind of measure by which I attempted to revive the term in this book. And the second is their strategic importance. These are often what people call emerging markets. These are the countries that have the energy resources, are growing consumer markets, have rising industrial manufacturing and export bases. They have huge currency reserves and are launching their own sovereign wealth funds and are competing or buying Western companies. All of these things are emerging out of second world countries, particularly, let's say, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, the financial power that Russia has today, India and the like. And that's why they're the ones that I focus the book on.
A lot of people consider India to be neck and neck with China as potentially a world superpower. Can you talk about why you disagree with that?
Well, I mean, India isn't at the present moment anywhere near China in terms of its share of the global economy. China is, 12-13% and more. India is at about 1-1.5%. So it's a gigantic step behind. It also doesn't have the global reach at the moment in terms of its diplomacy and economic relations that China has. Everywhere in the world, people are affected by Chinese demand. So in Brazil and Argentina, beef, soy, cattle, all these things, are, and of course, copper, zinc, minerals, all over the world, Chinese consumption of these commodities has an impact on local economies. You don't feel that happening as a result of India's growth yet. Then there's just the question of the diplomatic and strategic appetite. China wants to be and is becoming a superpower already. India still needs to decide what it really wants to be and how it's going to do it. It's not clear yet that it does want to be a superpower, and if so, on what time horizon it could actually achieve that, and to what end, really. There's a big debate in India that isn't really there in China as to, what are we doing this for?
You characterize Saudi Arabia as being very much up for grabs, despite the U.S. efforts to have a strong relationship with Saudi Arabia. Does that mean that we're not using our strategies there and in other places, perhaps, to our advantage?
I wanted to make perfectly clear in this book that countries like Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt, which people think of when they wake up in the morning as, oh, well, that's an American ally. We've been giving them money. We have strong diplomatic relations with them. We force Egypt to recognize Israel. Pakistan is, the ally in the war on terror. I wanted everyone to see perfectly clearly that these countries think for themselves. They don't do our bidding in any real tangible way anymore. You have the case of Saudi Arabia and OPEC, where, of course, they recently snubbed Bush's request to increase oil production to lower prices. You have the case of Egypt, where just because we give them aid, its value has declined substantially over the last several decades, and a lot of the money that they raise now in the capital markets that goes into the defense budget buys weapons from China, not from us. I wanted to point out that our share of foreign investment in Saudi Arabia, which used to be so high, is now, is still greater than, but increasingly on par with that from Europe and from China and Asian countries, which means that the Saudi government has much more flexibility in saying, no, we're not going to do it according to American rules or work with American companies. We're going to work with Asians. China and India and other Asian countries are far larger consumers of Saudi Arabian oil than the United States is. And Saudi Arabia and the Gulf Cooperation Council may soon have a free trade area with the European Union. And as you probably also know, to some extent, oil markets might start to denominate or price oil in euros. So I wanted to make, I wanted everyone to understand the ways in which these countries really do play all sides at the same time.
Well, with a state like Egypt, where we're spending billions of dollars in aid every year, it's almost like an extortion situation that you're describing, because if we cut that aid, clearly we're going to lose their alliance entirely, aren't we?
$1 billion just doesn't buy you what it used to anymore. And, to fast forward just a little bit, part of the prescription of the book is we need to really step up. I mean, a limited amount of aid that is tied and conditional to all sorts of reforms that people may not want to undertake, or to purchasing support or from American contractors that are inefficient and not operating according to the needs of the local context, is hardly giving people what they want. And so we need to be much more clear as to understanding the real value or lack of value in the relationship that we have with different countries.
Parag Khanna is my guest. He is Senior Research Fellow at the New America Foundation. His new book is called The Second World, Empires and Influence in the New Global Order. We'll return to our conversation after the break. You can get on the line now to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
We'll be right back.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Senior Research Fellow at the New America Foundation, Parag Khanna. His new book is called The Second World, Empires and Influence in the New Global Order. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-7.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Think at KERA.org. What sort of power, Parag, exists for swing states right now?
A lot, a great deal, because in an era where we feel that our global stature and influence is diminishing, we need all the help and all the allies and friends that we can get. But we find that at precisely that moment that America is realizing that it needs to reconnect with the world or regroup with allies and find new allies, the countries either that we've relied on, such as, again, as we discussed earlier, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, and Egypt, are also starting to play on this global, you know, what I call the geopolitical marketplace and make friends with just about everyone. So the leverage is for those consumers, which are the second world countries in that marketplace, that are saying, well, you know, sure, we'll do something with you, America, but we've also got this and this going on with Europe and this going on with the Chinese. It'll be very hard for there to be any truly reliable and universally, agenda-wise, broadly reliable allies ever again.
If all of these second world states maintain kind of a tripod stance and have connections and ties with all the three major superpowers, does that help contribute to world stability?
That is actually what remains to be seen. I mean, we're dealing with a multipolar world in which there are multiple superpowers, and historically that can be unstable. I would imagine that it's particularly unstable in an era that isn't like 19th century Europe, but rather in the 21st century, where we have a non-Western superpower such as China, and a rising India and an unpredictable Russia. So things are very potentially unstable. And then you have all of these second world countries, where a lot of the energy is, that are themselves potentially unstable, like Saudi Arabia and Iran and so forth. So yes, I mean, I wouldn't place my money on a peaceful world order in the 21st century.
So you think it's actually more unstable to have three world powers, because it's a totally different dynamic than when you have two or even one.
Right. Well, the thing is, the era in which people believed, which was, the 1990s, that the world was and would remain unipolar was spectacularly brief. And I think that we, sort of thought about the triumph in the Cold War as, heralding an entire century, basically, of American dominance. But what we didn't realize was that globalization, which really also accelerated in the 1990s, was not synonymous with Americanization. And what globalization has done is increase the power of China and enhance the leverage and reach of the European Union and empowered second world countries very, very quickly. So we have to come to terms with that world, not the world in which America is on top just because we won the Cold War.
Parag Khanna is my guest. His new book is called The Second World, Empires and Influence in the New Global Order. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak first to Tim in Dallas. Hi, Tim.
Hey, great show as always.
Thank you.
A quick question. Obviously, the United States government, as well as several of our corporations, have got a major financial interest and investment in countries such as China and Saudi Arabia that have practices as far as the human rights standpoint that are well below our standards. And were we not to have the investments that we do in them, I wonder if, in fact, we would have anything to do with them at all or to try and change those policies. My question for your guest is, does he see that trend continuing as it is now? Does he see that trend growing? In other words, we have to kind of kowtow to values that we certainly wouldn't agree with, but the dollar seems to win out each time. Or at a certain point, do we finally just say, okay, look, the money makes sense here, but we just can't continue to do this because it just does not make sense morally or ethically. Thanks a lot.
Thanks for your call.
It's a good question. And unfortunately, the answer is that it's a case-by-case basis, because where the spotlight is shined on a bad and an odious regime such as that of Islam Karimov in Uzbekistan after he conducted a massacre in 2004 against his people, it obviously was a bad time to have a strong military relationship with them, such as we did, because it's a country that borders Afghanistan to the north. And so we closed our base and moved out. And in a way, it was couched as an eviction notice from them under pressure pressure from Russia and China to other countries whose human rights records, of course, we are nothing to sort of write home about. But then there are other cases where, you know, we obviously turn a blind eye, such as decades of our relations with Saudi Arabia. So it depends ultimately on how much public pressure there is and how much one sort of what the calculation is at any given time of the perceived cost of maintaining relations with different countries. I mean, Egypt doesn't have a great human rights record, but we maintain our support for Mubarak. If we were actually ever going to be universal about things like democracy and human rights, we would probably not have relations with anyone. And so, in a way, the caller is right in saying that oftentimes the dollar does win out. And then there are countries where it's very low cost to beat them over the, you know, sort of browbeat them on human rights, like Burma, because we don't have deep relations with them. American corporations sometimes complain, of course, that, you know, they can't have relations with these countries, although they would like to, especially if they have energy, such as Burma. And there have been cases, of course, with Unocal and others, you know, in that country. So, you know, to be perfectly honest, it's case by case, and it's going to remain that way.
Beyond even the question of human rights, how can the U.S. and the EU persuade China to start taking on a bigger role commensurate to the kind of money it's investing elsewhere in humanitarian aid?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, it is a huge humanitarian donor in Africa. It's moved up alongside the U.S. and EU as the third largest donor and investor to African countries. And again, this really plays to my overall picture of a world in which these three, everywhere you look, seem to be the largest investors and have the most strategic kind of interest. Now, there is a very, you know, the way in which you phrase the question almost implies that, you know, right now they're just focused on resources and aren't doing much for development, and we need to get them to play to our standards. There's a whole different point of view that a surprising number of even Western analysts of international aid point to, which is that what have we really tangibly delivered for quite a few African countries over whose you know, development policies we've dominated for the past 40 years in the post-colonial kind of era? You know, not a whole lot. Meanwhile, China has come in and built roads and government buildings and railroad tracks and invested in mineral resources that haven't been exploited. It's doing that for itself, yes, but it is also providing some public goods to those populations or to those countries. Now, is it doing it through giving money to regimes rather than to people? Yes, but I assure you we've had that problem as well for a long time. If we didn't have that problem, Africa wouldn't be poor today, or it would be a lot less poor if we really were all that benevolent and successful in our aid policy. So I have to say that on this issue, it really does cut both ways. The question is, who is delivering the goods? Because it's not about how we view China in our eyes. It's how do these target populations in Africa view China. Right now, many of them seem very content to be receiving the kinds of physical, tangible benefits from China's presence that they did not get from us. So we can talk about how, you know, how sort of, you know, how they don't respect human rights and whatnot. But as far as many people are concerned, they're actually delivering things that we always failed to. So we probably need to step up and deliver more.
Well, that's an interesting point of view, because certainly there has been the criticism recently that a lot of Western and specifically American aid agencies and organizations measure their success according to how much money has been spent, as opposed to looking at the long-term impact of the money that was
spent.
Right,
and again, that's because we are so just self-absorbed and insular in our thinking. I mean, if someone, you know, you can have someone in Washington say, but we gave $5 billion or even more, of course, to Afghanistan, but ask how much, you know, one short stretch of road cost that was built by one American contractor, ask how much the tunnel cost linking two parts of the U.S. embassy under a street that has been closed off to the public anyway. That counts as aid. So I'm sorry, but when you really measure by how much money actually helps people on the ground, we don't really fare all that well. Others may not either. Europe is very bureaucratic. China also demands that almost all the money go back to Japan, to Japanese contractors and the like. But we are not angels in this business.
Parag Khanna is my guest. He's Senior Research Fellow at the New America Foundation, and his new book is called The Second World, Empires and Influence in the New Global Order. Our email address is think@kera.org. The phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go next to Nagatu in Dallas. Hi, Nagatu.
Yeah, how are you?
Fine, thank you.
He touched many points that I would like to raise, such as most of third world countries and Arab countries, we are only supplying money and support for those dictators. The people get nothing and just suffering. Eventually, those dictators will go away and the people will take power when there is a real democracy. And Chinese are doing better job by doing making building infrastructures in Africa.
I think the caller is
Yeah, go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, no, I think that he's more or less you know, restating that previous point, that it's true people want to see tangible benefits, not just rhetoric of democracy. The interesting thing is that it may be, and you know, I obviously don't disagree, that Western liberal democracy is a great system of governance, and one that it would be nice for other countries to have. But you have to understand what a humongous stretch that is for countries in Africa or in Asia to just become like us. It's not that they don't want to be. It's that by not helping them all that much, we are not accelerating the process. China, meanwhile, represents a certain middle tangible path that they can look to emulate, not by looking back to our history in the 18th and 19th centuries, but looking at the last 20 years and saying, this is a country that was very poor, it focused on economic growth and generating exports, and it's worrying later on about political reform. There's nothing unsensible about that, and it represents something that African countries can do today, even if they remain very corrupt, even if they struggle with human rights, even if they have authoritarian regimes. They can at least try and do those things, and eventually maybe that will help them democratize. As wealthier countries do, of course, tend to be democratic. What they cannot do is just eliminate their history and become like America overnight.
Another key second world state that you write a lot about is Brazil. And Mark in Garland writes via email, could you speak to class disparities in Brazil and those in other second world nations?
Absolutely. And again, that's one of the sort of paramount characteristics of second world countries. It's the income and class disparities and inequalities within society. Of course, Brazil ranks as one of the most unequal countries in the world, alongside China, Turkey, and others. And of course, there's also a class issue in Brazil, as there is in many other second world countries as well. But the reason I give a certain benefit of the doubt in my book to Brazil and over all the space that I give to it is that the efforts that they are making to alleviate poverty and to invest in the sort of Amazonian areas and developing tribal populations, providing health care and confronting disease and all of these things are really quite noble and well-intentioned and innovative and progressive in ways that I don't see in other countries. I don't say for sure that they will necessarily succeed, but I do find their efforts more laudable than what I see in other countries, such as in the Middle East. So Brazil, I give some credit to. The other, obviously, major thing about Brazil in terms of its potential is that it's not reliant on a single industry. It's not like Venezuela that's entirely dependent on oil. And when oil prices collapse and the Chavez regime collapse, they'll be back where they were before. Brazil is very diverse in its economy. Agriculture is massive, but it's only 10-15%. It's a huge manufacturing power as well. So I am very sort of optimistic about that country in the long run. But other countries, again, the task of governance in a second world country is attempting to bridge those divides before they wind up splitting the country in two. And I can't say about certain other places like Indonesia, which is so divided both and so diverse ethnically, spiritually, even religiously and geographically, that it will actually survive into, you know, that much longer as a coherent country. It actually isn't even a coherent country today.
You also see a lot of potential for Chile, even as compared with Brazil. Can you talk about what's going right there?
Well, the thing about very small populated countries, Chile is a large country with obviously a very unique shape, physical shape, that is.
It's long and skinny.
Long and skinny. But the key issue here is the fact that it has not a very large population, I think just 5, 6, 7 million people or so. When you have a population that's small and you have mineral resources, Chile has copper and other resources, when you can with a good government, as Chile has had over the last, you know, 10 plus years, you can spread the wealth, develop good social policy, a lot of emphasis on education, a lot of emphasis on infrastructure, so actually uniting the people of the country in a way, which is very difficult in Chile, so they deserve even more credit for that. So focusing on education, infrastructure, pensions, Employment, social protections, all of these kinds of things really do help, and obviously just political stability. These things make the difference between a second and a third world country, and Chile has been doing remarkably well on that score. Again, it's easier when it's a small population. A lot of people, for example, you know, have seen the chapter of my book on Singapore, and I talk about the kind of iconic status that Singapore has, and everyone wants to copy Singapore. Dubai wants to copy Singapore. Even China wants to copy Singapore. With only 4 million people on a small sort of, you know, peninsular tip, it's very difficult, but it's a unique story what Singapore has become. It's very hard to copy that. So I look at countries like Libya and Azerbaijan that have resources, have small populations, and I look very closely at whether or not they're doing the kinds of things that Chile is doing in order to assess whether or not they have the potential of becoming first world stable states.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Parag Khanna. His new book is called The Second World, Empires and Influence in the New Global Order. Let's speak next to Carl in Dallas. Hi, Carl.
Hi. I have a question, and that is that sooner or later, whether it be sooner or later, I'm assuming that the U.S. presence in Iraq will diminish or be extinguished altogether. At that point, would Iran be the leader in that region? And if so, what would be the consequence for the pressure on the border with Saudi Arabia and other oil-producing countries?
It's a great question. It certainly is the sort of, you know, paramount geopolitical question in the Middle East right now, not the Israel-Palestine dispute. This is obviously the Saudi Arabia-Iran-Iraq issue is what people are really thinking about when they talk about long-term stability in that region. And, you know, Iran already is the de facto most influential country in Iraq, not us. I mean, it's obviously a majority of the population of Iraq is Shia, which is not to say that they have immediate loyalty to Iran. There's a very strong Shia nationalism in Iraq as well. But their ability to influence the country's political decisions, its political class, some of its foreign relations. In fact, the Iraqi government has even last year already recognized Iran's right to a peaceful nuclear program, which was obviously a diplomatic victory for Iran. Then, of course, there's Iran's influence through Syria and Lebanon and elsewhere. So it's, you know, it's quite a powerful regional player, and it is, of course, the most populous country in the area. So especially when the U.S. withdraws, we'll need to have a different strategy for containing Iran, as it were. And I don't think the U.S. government thus far has a very, you know, sort of strong strategy for doing that. We're too busy just dealing with Iraq today as it is.
Parag Khanna is my guest. He's senior research fellow at the New America Foundation. His new book is called The Second World, Empires and Influence in the New Global Order. We'll be back to our discussion in just a moment. If you'd like to join us, you can send email to think@kera.org or you can call 1-800.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, a way to keep your greatest two tools, creativity and curiosity, sharp. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Parag Khanna. He is a senior research fellow at the New America Foundation. His new book is called The Second World, Empires and Influence in the New Global Order. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. The email address is think@kera.org. Let's go next to J.D. in Dallas. Hi, J.D.
Hello. Yes, I have a question for the guest.
Okay.
It has to do with population density. We often hear, you know, and we know that that can have bad effects. However, are there any good effects of population density? And I'll get off the air.
Thanks for your call.
I mean, in research today, I think the most commonly cited benefit of having populations accumulate in certain areas is in newly industrializing urban centers or special economic zones or regional business hubs, places like Dubai or the planned King Abdullah Economic City, or in coastal China, where you've had a huge increase in population, but it's served to increase the labor force in factories or in export processing zones, and that's brought enormous wealth, which has then, you know, filtered inward to spread development. So not overpopulation as such, but increased population density, when managed well, can obviously lead to tremendous amounts of economic growth.
What's notable about the idea of three superpowers is that this really represents a rise for the EU and for China, and a bit of a slip in terms of global dominance for the United States. How does that make our approach to all of this different from those two entities?
You know, before it used to be either you're with us or get out of the way, and then in the war on terror it became you're with us, you're here against us. But now it's sort of, if you're not with us, who else might you be with? And what it requires is us to really understand the psychology a lot better of the countries that we're trying to relate to and win influence over. What are their priorities? What are they willing to give and take on at a given time? We can't just make all or nothing demands anymore, because again, in this geopolitical marketplace, people can get the money they want, the weapons they want, the political assistance they want from someone else, particularly from Europe or from China. So we have to understand each country on a case-by-case basis a lot more deeply in making policy, rather than this broad brushstroke kind of stuff that says like the Islamic world or the Middle East. I try never to use concepts like that in my book, because they're not really helpful in understanding the specifics of individual countries. And so, you know, that's kind of why I organize my book according to these individual country chapters.
You've written about the fact, and it's very interesting, that Chinese business people are much more culturally sensitive, and we don't want to assume that this is the case for everyone, but much more culturally sensitive in many cases than Americans, to the extent that they will learn the language and they will take on a name that makes sense in the country where they're doing business.
Right, yeah, I mentioned that example. So in the Middle East, that's the case. But of course, that also has to do with the fact that their names may be more difficult to acquire or pronounce. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, no matter how powerful China becomes, we obviously have, you know, people around the world, you know, learning English far more easily, and it is an easier language to learn. But on a more specific, tangible level, I look at the example of Brazil, where even though China's growing exports are wiping out, like the shoe and other kinds of industries in Brazil, China is trying to make up for that in a way by offering Brazilian businessmen the ability to buy into Chinese factories at lower rates so that they can share in the profits, so that Brazilians and Brazilian firms don't get too upset or disenfranchised by the fact that they are competing a lot with China. So that's an example of a clever, deferential business tactic that helps maintain a positive image for China in a country where, even though they have economic complementarities, they're also competing a lot.
You know, reading about the way loyalties sort of shift much more quickly in this world, where economics is really the driver of alliances, it strikes me as the same as people who are in their 20s and 30s and 40s not expecting to stay with a company for decades and decades. Their loyalties sort of go as far as what's convenient for them. And I'm wondering if there are ways to maximize these sort of short-term economic alliances so that we are getting from them what we need to without exploiting the people on the other side of the relationship.
Well, I mean, again, it is very case by case. I hate to disappoint you in lacking in sort of grand rhetoric, although my book is full of, you know, sweeping statements. But I do believe that we've, you know, if anything, overdone the notion of big strategies and theories and all of that. And I'd like to see a lot more specific sort of fine tuning or calibration of our foreign policy, so that we understand where certain economies want to go, how we can help them get there. I talk about, for example, labor standards. You know, it's one thing to just say to Bangladesh, you know, you need to improve your labor standards. It's another thing if we actually help them achieve it. I mean, part of the reason we have this problem with NAFTA right now is that it's been really purely an economic relationship on a certain level, but without the kinds of political and social sort of transformation that people had expected. We'd expected that as the economy grows, there would be less migration to the United States and illegal immigration and so forth, but we haven't seen the politics evolve as much. Now, where has been the support from the United States actually changed those things? And then again, the same thing goes for all the other countries from which we demand higher labor standards and human rights and so forth. Where is the technical assistance that we need to provide to help people get there. Everyone knows they need to have higher labor standards or should have higher labor standards and provide dignified kind of work. Everyone else tells them that too. The International Labor Organization tells them that. Our value and our virtue and our credibility and the loyalty that we would receive will actually come from helping people, not just telling them.
For such a long time, Parag, it seemed that our geographic isolation was an advantage for us in terms of being a superpower. We weren't easily attacked. We were far away from things that might be happening elsewhere that would cause us to be less stable. Is that now a disadvantage?
To be far away?
Yeah,
it's
geographically.
That's a fantastic question. And I'll tell you, the reason is because, you know, this geopolitics, which is the discipline on which this book is based, is about geography fundamentally, and globalization doesn't erode that responsibility. For decades, America ran the world, so to speak, during the Cold War. We had this massive alliance system through NATO and many troops in Europe, and then at simultaneously the largest military presence and certainly the most powerful military presence in the Pacific, on the Pacific Rim, which we still also have. But that is increasingly expensive and tenuous as other powers build up. And so to get anywhere, so to speak, you have to move to the other side of the world. The reason we keep troops in Europe is not because Europe is any risk of being unstable. It's because Europe is closer to, quote unquote, the action. And so, yes, it is very, very costly and increasingly difficult. Look at Central Asia, where there's a lot of competition for energy resources over there. We don't border Central Asia, but China does and Russia does, and Europe is very close. It's easier for them to spread their influence through roads and through industry over into that region, much, much harder than it is for us. We actually need to concentrate again on our own geography, because Latin America, which is so neglected in foreign policy, is a big part of the solution to America's geopolitical woes. The Western Hemisphere has all of the energy resources that America needs to decouple itself from the Middle East, but we don't have strong enough, we haven't had strong enough relations with Latin American countries, and we need to really go back and focus on it. It seems boring or dull or peripheral to policymakers. Latin America, I almost had to fight to keep the chapter on it in the book. It's actually very, very important to our future.
How would you start with Mexico?
You know, I mentioned, you know, NAFTA earlier. On the one hand, you have, political leaders saying they're going to question NAFTA or not repeal NAFTA, but all free trade agreements need to be revisited. That's what Democratic candidates are saying. On the other hand, you have a movement towards the so-called North American Union, which is something that has been floated among leaders and about which the Council on Foreign Relations also did a study, in which there would be much deeper security, political kind of relationship between Canada, United States, and Mexico. So it's a very polarized kind of issue. I believe, as I said earlier, that if we actually want to decrease illegal immigration from Mexico and through Mexico into the United States and decrease drug smuggling from there, we obviously have to work a lot more, not just on having some factories on the border produce cheaply for the United States, but work a lot more on social reform and investment and development. It's a highly unequal society, Mexico, and it requires a lot more grassroots kind of sustainable microenterprise and all these kinds of things that we haven't done nearly enough to help to develop in that country. The example that I compare it to is Europe's relationship with Turkey. You know, Turkey may never become a member of the European Union formally, but over 40 years, it's had an ever more strong demographic, economic, and other kinds of relations with Europe that have really helped to modernize the country in a broader and broader way. It's still very unequal. The eastern part of the country is still underdeveloped. But if you go there, then you will see that because of more open Turkish migration, a lot of promotion from European companies to invest more through Turks across Turkey is actually helping to stimulate development in the far corners of the country in ways that weren't the case before. And it's the same kind of thing that we would need to do in Mexico.
Do you think that EU pressure is likely to get Turkey to actually pull out of the occupied areas of Cyprus anytime in the near future?
That's a really good question. It's one of those quote-unquote frozen conflicts, though it's a term I really hate to use because they're never really frozen. There's always agitation. It's certainly devoid of progress, that's for sure. I certainly wish that they had not given EU membership to Cyprus before having resolved the dispute. That was a very dumb, in my opinion, diplomatic move because it removed a lot of the leverage that they had over Cyprus to push towards resolution of the issue, irrespective of whose favor it went in. You know, obviously it is one of the levers that the EU has over Turkey to say, you know, you'll never actually become a member until the Cyprus situation is resolved and you either, you know, pull out or something like that. But it's not a stick that the EU has actively wielded yet, because there's so many other factors with Turkey in its internal politics that that put it, you know, quite a few years away from EU membership. So it's not something that is an immediate priority for either side, it seems.
One of the things you've recommended is to sort of remake the State Department so that lower-ranking officials could exercise the same kind of power that their counterparts might in the Pentagon. Can you talk about what difference that might make?
I actually think it would make a big difference. Look, you know, a superpower is 24/7 worldwide, needs to be on top of issues all over the place. It can't be North Korea one day, you know, Iran the next day, Israel-Palestine the third day, Venezuela the fourth day, and then whatever else, and war on terror or something the fifth day. It's all of those things every day, all the time. I don't think prioritization is the solution here if you actually want to be or pretend to be a superpower that is on top of everything and exercising leadership. If you don't want that of this country, then that's fine. But if you do, then you really do need a diplomatic structure that is more global, more robust, more attuned to everything that's going on. And the reason I make the comparison to the Pentagon, that has more stronger regional policies. The assistant secretaries of state who coordinate regional affairs in the Bureau of Political Affairs of the State Department don't have a lot of power. Whereas the regional commanders, CENTCOM, PAYCOM, SOCOM, and the like, or other SOUTHCOM, in the Pentagon do have an enormous amount of power to coordinate regionally across borders, to get commanding officers for different countries or policies across countries to be more coordinated, to have more transnational kinds of programs and projects and policies. State Department has a very hard time doing that. For example, if you look at aid, you know, USAID is done country by country. The Millennium Challenge Corporation has chosen, you know, 12, 15, 20 countries one by one to work with. That doesn't help spark the kind of internal regional development and cooperation that we need to see happen for countries to take control of their own destiny and their own development. So the State Department lags really far behind the Pentagon, actually, in regional sorts of thinking. And by changing the process of policymaking and the bureaucracy, you might have some progress in that area.
You recommended a G3 between the EU, China, and the U.S. What would the key issues be at its first meeting?
I've talked about what I recommended in saying that was that climate change would certainly be one where one would say, okay, at what price and how can Europe and the United States provide clean technology to China? What price can they pay for it? How can there be a assistance structure to implement it? And how can that model be duplicated for other rapidly industrializing and heavy greenhouse gas emitting countries like India and the like? I think that would be a very important topic of conversation. Another one would, of course, be oil supplies, energy security. How can we not compete to get oil from you know, countries or the same country at the same time, but figure out how there can be better oil stockpiling in Asia where demand for oil has grown so much. What can they learn? Japan, for example, has huge oil. It doesn't have oil of its own, but maintains very large reserves and stockpiles. Other countries could benefit a lot from doing that, and it could help lower the price of oil. Another one would be, you know, so-called rogue states. Every country that we call a rogue state is a country that China backs militarily, financially, diplomatically. How are we going to untangle that in each of these countries one by one in order to avoid there being an actual clash or conflict among powers over or in those countries when they don't agree on where it should go? So those would be three of the things that I would put towards the top of that agenda.
Is there, very briefly, is there any advantage to the long-term security of the United States to not be the sole superpower?
Advantage, I don't know. I mean, the fact is that we can't afford it and we're not doing a great job of it, and it's actually impossible to do anyway. So we have no choice but to try and make the reality of a multipolar world, you know, more cost effective for us than it is at present. And that requires something like this G3 dialogue. So again, we have absolutely no choice in the matter. We have to pursue this course of a new multilateral order.
Farag Khanna is Senior Research Fellow at the New America Foundation. His new book is called The Second World, Empires and Influence in the New Global Order. Farag, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Chris.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.